White Rocket Entertainment.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello, and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and this week I am joined again by my regular co-host, John Ringer. Welcome back aboard, John.
Thanks a lot, Van. Very excited to be here today.
And as we always say, 9 times out of 10 lately, if you're on the show, it's either to talk about James Bond or Game of Thrones. What is it tonight?
Game of Thrones.
And we are finishing up season 6. This has really been unprecedented, and I think it says a lot about how much, certainly I have, and I guess you too, have enjoyed this season, that we've actually done this will be the third episode on one season. I mean, We did one episode on all of last season at the end of season 5, but we've actually had to just say, let's just go ahead and do one now. 3 times now.
So, it's true.
So this will be, in some ways, our overview of the whole season, but I think you and I both probably figure we'll just concentrate mainly on the last 3 because we've already covered the first 7 in 2 previous episodes. So if you're just now finding this episode and you'd like to hear what John and I said about previous ones, just go to you can go to iTunes and scroll back through our feed, just, you know, the way you found this show. Or go to whiterocket.podbean.com, and you can see all of our episodes all the way back to number 1 there. I think that's pretty much the way to do it. Or you can just Google White Rocket Podcast, Game of Thrones Season 6, and you'll probably find them all on Google that way. So anyway, you can find them easily enough. So I think we should get right on into the Season 6 last 3 in. What do you think?
Before we do that, we have to give our regular spoiler warning. We are going to discuss in detail the TV show Game of Thrones and the season 6 episodes, and we are going to reference the books and things that happen in the books that may or may not happen in the TV show. And if you don't want to learn any of those things, if you haven't watched the episodes yet, stop listening. If you haven't read the books and you don't want to hear any book speculation, stop listening, because we're going to go there.
If you don't care anything about the books and are just enjoying the TV show, then it won't bother you one way or another, so come on aboard.
Yeah, then it's just fun.
Yeah. So, as I always do lately, I've been out doing yard work and grilling, so as we get ready for this thirsty work here, I'm going to crack open a nice Minute Maid. There we go. Giggle, 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 giggle. Sounds good, doesn't it?
Nice.
Over the ice. Okay, so John, the first thing we got to talk about is what?
Well, I guess the first thing, most immediate thing is, how did you feel in the immediate aftermath of the season finale? What was your gut reaction before we get into the nitty gritty of all the different plot elements? Just your feeling as a show watcher. It would satisfied, unhappy.
At the end of number 10?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, I was jumping up and down. Let me set the scene real quick. The last 3 episodes we knew were going to be big. My wife and I figured were going to be big. And so we came down to the basement, which we only use for like watching a big movie or something, you know, because I've got a whole wall. I have a sheet on to watch like 15-foot wide projector, you know, and huge sound system down here. We watched the last 3 episodes that way. And at the end, when it showed all the ships and the dragons and Danny on the ship and everything, I was just like, holy cow, I just couldn't believe it. And it looked amazing on the wall like that. So I was glad we did it that way. But yeah, I mean, it's what we've been waiting on since basically
season 3.
Well, it's what I've been waiting on since I first started reading the books in 2001, 2002.
That's right.
When the third volume came out is when I started reading the books and caught up very quickly. And that always seemed so far away. And it seemed with every book that came out, it seemed like we were not getting closer, but further away, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think we're going to talk about that a little bit as we go along. But one of the things that's been kind of strange is if you read the books through like number four particularly, it felt like it felt like running on the beach and you see something off the distance and the faster you run toward it, the further it seems to get away, you know? That's what this has been like. It's like in the first book, you could see him wrapping it up in three books. But by the time you read the third book, you feel like it's going to take him a couple more books. And by the time you read the fourth, you're like, oh, we got a long way to go. We got a lot of words still to go under the bridge on this thing. So, which is exactly the, exactly the opposite with the TV show, because as of this season, you get the sense that we're actually, that objects in the mirror are closer than they appear, you know?
Well, again, in the TV show, there are 16 or so 1 hour episodes left, and that's it.
They got to get going.
And that includes, like, if you have one at the end that tells, like, the, you know, what happened after the finale comes.
Right, right. So I think we got more about that coming up in our agenda a little bit later. So how did you feel after the season finale?
I was very happy. I was delighted as somebody that loves the books, loves the show. I was very happy. It was kind of a Christmas morning for, you know, fans of the books and the show, because there were so many things that you wanted to see that they finally got there. And I said when we did our first podcast, the one thing I wanted to see was what you just talked about, Daenerys on a boat leaving Meereen, headed to Westeros, and we got that. So that alone would have made it a thumbs up for me, but there were about 20 other great things that we're going to get into. So,
well, didn't you say she was going to be on a boat before the season was over?
I said, we did our podcast after last season. I said at the end of next season, Dany will be on a boat going to Westeros. And I said it at the beginning of this season. I said the only thing that I wanted from this entire season was Dany on a boat.
Even if she just like gotten in a canoe and paddled around the castle or something,
that would have been fine. Just sharp paddling to Westeros. We'll take it.
Well, did you think you were going to get it with like 2 minutes left in the episode?
Well, there were so many high points of the episode. Any of them they could have ended on.
Yeah.
But so I wasn't sure they were going to go there. But I did think it would be a great end shot, and they have tended to end seasons with big dramatic shots of her and her army. So I thought they might go there.
I got to say, by the way, I think that from this point forward, we need all of the remaining episodes written by DB and DB. And I think we need all the remaining episodes directed by Miguel Sapochnik, because I just thought the direction on these last two episodes has been spectacular. Major motion picture level.
Yes, whether you agree or disagree with the plot elements and what happened with the characters, the cinematography in that fight scene in episode 9, and then the cinematography of this one, the way the music built up very slowly, the piano music at the beginning with Cersei and then fire and stuff, I thought that was incredibly well done. And not the cinematography, and so many other scenes, and in the order and how they faded from one to another with the different views was really outstanding.
So we can kind of go through some of the highlights of these three episodes, and then we can just kind of do like I like to do, go around the horn one time and just check in on where everybody is at this point. So, all right. So, first up is episode 8, No One. Now, when we last spoke about Game of Thrones on this program, we were wondering what was up with Arya. Now, I don't think we need to rehash the whole thing, because if anybody interested enough in Game of Thrones to be listening to this show has probably heard the arguments already that... And by the way, let me just point out by referencing it back to the most recent episode, Arya is like a little girl, and she gets gut stabbed multiple times, including twisting the blade, and she can jog all over town, whereas the Lancel Lannister working for the Sparrows, he gets poked in the side one time by a little kid, and he's dragging his near dead body around, can't even blow out a candle.
I think the kid hamstrung him, but
okay. It's... well, it just seemed like they have wildly different reactions to getting stabbed, you know. It seemed like he was much worse off than Arya was. So, but anyway, so yeah, we went into number 8 wondering what was going on with Arya, and we had all kinds of wild theories, and we had some pretty good theories, and it turned out to be exactly what it looked like on the surface. What did you think about that?
I didn't love it, and I think episode 8, you know, and what happened with in 7 and 8 with Arya, I think was not one of the better points of the season. But the big thing is, just like getting Dany on a boat, it finished that plot line and right. got her out of there and got her back to Westeros. And that was the important thing.
Yeah. It's like, it could have been done better, but it worked out. It's kind of like, to use a football analogy from our other type of show, it's like winning the game by fumbling the ball all over the field, stumbling over backwards and falling on the ball in the end zone. It's not exactly an 80-yard beautiful touch pass to the receiver, but it gets the job done, you know?
That's
right. It
got
the job done. So, yeah, so I do think it would have been a lot better if it had been somebody else wearing Arya's face, or if it had been, you know, Arya pretending or some kind of a trick to suck the waif in, but you know, something like that. But ultimately, it just ended up being exactly what it looked like on the surface. It didn't make a lot of sense in terms of how she's able to do everything she did, having been stabbed so bad. The other thing I want to touch on while we're talking about Arya is it's been unclear the whole using faces thing. And I want to get your opinion on this. They've never established clearly how the putting on different faces works. So therefore, we had no idea if Arya was able to do it or not, and certainly if we didn't know if she was able to do it once she leaves the Faceless Men organization. Well, clearly, A, you can do it, and B, she can do it without being the Faceless Men. So what is your conclusion about all that now, if anything?
I think we have to look at Arya like she graduated from the Faceless Men. Like she passed the training and was fully qualified to be one.
She's a fully licensed faceless man.
Except she's not working for them. She's a, you know, a free agent, basically. Right.
Like every great assassin ninja type story where they go off on their own to be, you know, some kind of a freelance hitman or superhero.
And if you go back and watch the scene where, you know, Jaqen H'ghar gives her the coin, he promises basically to train her so that she can come back to Westeros to kill her enemies. And that's what he does.
Yeah.
You know, you think she's going to have to join their, you know, guild of secret assassins, whatever, but she doesn't. I think so. She learned how to do the face thing, and maybe she stole a couple and took them with her when she was leaving.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, that's fine. And I think she is, you know, very confident in her abilities in terms of moving around and poisoning people and killing people and that kind of thing. I think she has, you know, good experience with them and that. So I look forward to her kind of reign of terror as running around killing people.
Yeah, and we've waited a long time for her to get to that level, but it is kind of disturbing. I mean, there's the one thing, you know, about this show is on the one hand, it has certainly empowered people after going through a tough time, especially the two girls, Sansa and Arya. Dany, too. I mean, the women on this show suffer greatly, but they come out the other side stronger and tougher. But I'm afraid, unfortunately, it also makes them much harder and almost gleeful in killing. I mean, think about Sansa when she sicked Ramsay's dogs on him, and think about Arya when she killed Walder Frey. That's not, you know, what would Ned Stark's reaction be if he saw his two daughters behaving that way while people were getting killed, you know?
He would be unhappy, but it's also like Ned Stark was an idiot and he's dead.
Well, that's true.
And he's dead because he's an idiot. And I think his daughters have learned the hard lessons to not be that kind of person and are still learning them in terms of.
So young people, if you're listening out there, don't be good. The lesson of Game of Thrones is be pragmatic. It honestly is. People that try to be good get killed. People that try to be evil get killed. The people that survive are the ones that take things one thing at a time, and they operate purely on self-interest.
In that world, I don't. That's not how I'm going to live my life in this world.
Well, to quote Anthony Quinn in Lawrence of Arabia, I am an old dog, and these are new tricks. Yeah, I think we're setting our ways, but I would hate to think my little girl would grow up wanting to be anything like anybody on these shows. You know, you're either a wide-eyed optimist that meets a horrible end, or you're a cold-eyed pessimist that finds a way to, you know, slog through until somebody murders you. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of middle ground, really. Even Jon Snow's been killed once, you know, so, you know, it's pretty rough. Okay, so let's see. In episode 8, kind of specifically, I mean, the main thing we want to talk about was Arya, and she got revenge on the Waif. More about that in a second. Did you not want to basically have a recall election on Tommen when he outlawed the Clegane Bowl?
It was disappointing, but it also was, you know, they were, Cersei always had this one ace up her sleeve, and they were trying to outmaneuver her, and they did. You know, they thought.
Yeah. So we don't get the Clegane Bowl. Oh,
we don't get it yet. Again,
where was the mountain? Mountain wasn't in the Sept, was he? No.
No, he was keeping Tommen in his room.
Mm-hmm. Good, okay. So that kind of led us more towards Cersei's crazy gambit at the end. We had the whole business with River Run. Now, help me out here. Exactly what did all that accomplish? Let's just run through it real quick.
So Jaime goes up there with the army. He has Edmure Tully. He threatens to kill him and his family if he doesn't, you know, open the gate. So he lets Edmure go. Edmure goes into the castle and orders it to surrender, and Jaime takes it over.
And the Blackfish was mad because he didn't want them to do that. And so he goes and ends up getting killed, helping Brienne and
Pod
escape. And then Jaime sees them in the boat and kind of waves bye-bye. And off they sail. So what did we accomplish other than getting Brienne and Jaime back together for a brief moment to kind of like, you can have the sword, it belongs to you now? And
I think that was an important scene. And I think the scene where Jaime talks to Edmure, I think you get a sense of what, you know, of Jaime and the kind of things he's willing to do.
Yeah.
And you think, wow, that's harsh. And then you end up seeing what Cersei does. So, you know, he says he wants to get back to her as fast as he can. And that's what he's willing to do. But so I think it got Jaime and Brienne together. But it also, it may serve another purpose in terms of it got Brienne to the Riverlands. And she's got to get back to the North now. And she may run into some other characters, you know, the Brotherhood Without Banners and the Hound and maybe some of those people again, maybe Melisandre. So
the stuff with Jaime and the Walder brothers was hilarious.
Yes.
That was some great, it was worth it just for that. It was totally worth it just for that. The Blackfish is dead. They sail away. Oh, but it did also remind us of how much we hate the phrase. I'll give them that, right? I mean, if nothing else, it reminded us what a bunch of dumbasses the phrase are and how horrible, how they all needed to die. And we'll see how that plays out. Now, back over across the Narrow Sea, there is Tyrion trying to hold things together. When the slavers renege on their deal and show up, just like Grey Worm and Missandei warned, and they're bombarding the crap out. I appreciate the slavers' fine craftsmanship on flaming ballistas.
Mm-hmm.
They could build some darn fine. I've never seen seagoing ballistas before.
Sure.
Ocean-going or seagoing siege craft. That's pretty good.
Sometimes ships used to use them to shoot at each other, but they would be useful for that kind of. Sometimes they used to make almost kind of barge kind of things for that purpose. But
man, you wouldn't want to be on a ship and get hit by one of those things. Good Lord. That'd be worse than the dragons getting into you like they did. All right. So, yeah. So when things are getting really bad, Danny shows up and walks in. And, man, she has got purpose about her now, doesn't she? She ever since she got captured by the Dothraki this beginning of this, you know, end of last season, beginning of this season, she seems like a different person. She's got so much. She carries herself so royally now, so regally. She's got so much self-confidence, you know? I mean, she always, you could see her getting more and more that way. But I think over the course of this season, really starting with when she set the building on fire that the Dothraki were in, from that moment forward, she has just gotten hardcore, you know?
But probably riding a dragon will give you that kind of confidence.
Yeah, I think so. And surviving a giant fire, everybody else burns up. That brings me to a point I do want to raise real quick, which is, you know, we've been rooting for Danny to some degree to go across the sea, you know, all this time, but I'm at the point now, and I may have mentioned this previously, I'm no longer sure that's in the best interest of the people of Westeros. I mean, you know, early on, think about it this way, early on in the show and in the books, you hated the Lannisters so much, you hated the Freys so much, you really didn't care what happened as long as they got what was coming to them. But we're so far removed from that now, and the poor peasants of the countryside are trying so hard to get their acts back together and get their lives back together. Do we really want a Category 5 hurricane named the Dothraki Blood Riders impacting the shore? I'm just not sure anymore.
Van, that versus the reign of Mad Queen Cersei. Okay, those are your two options. And in that case, I'll pick the Dothraki every day of the week.
I guess it's true that it's a good thing in a way for the story that they've made Cersei so bad and crazy now. Because honestly, when she was just chilling in her castle drinking wine all day, I'm thinking that's probably like the best government Westeros has ever had.
No, she was terrible.
Nobody's setting fire to people.
She was terrible. I mean,
well, the government, but the state was being run basically by Kevin. And everything was rolling along pretty nice.
That was the best it's been run in a while.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I'm just not sure that it's in the...
But if Kevin was still around, I wouldn't say that. But he's extra crispy like everybody else. So.
Yeah, no kidding. And the dead are coming, as Davos said. So I think we're going to need all the armies we can get when the White Walkers arrive. So let's see. A couple other things about episode 8. The Hound. At what point were we with the Hound in this episode? Is this the one where he went looking for the people that killed? We already talked about the episode where he was out eating or something, and they came and killed everybody in his little church group, right?
Right. That was the one before this. That was the one where he reappeared. So then he went and he kills a couple guys with the axe, and then he finds other guys, and the Brotherhood already has their hands in a noose, and the Hound meets up with the Brotherhood and then kills them.
That too. I mean, that episode had some great humor in it, and the Hound is so funny dealing with those guys. Like, they're negotiating how many he gets to kill and how many the other guys get to kill, and he starts swinging his axe into them, and he's like, he tells the guy, I'll tone my language here, but he says, like, you'll crap at dying. The Hound is awesome. I was just so happy to have him back. And then lastly, Arya is trying to heal that she takes the opium basically from the actress. And then when she wakes up, the waif has just killed the actress. And we have a long running battle that ends in Arya's little house, little cave, where she cuts off the sword. She uses a needle, I almost said sting, to put out the candle. And then it's on because the waif has not been training blind like she has. And then what did you make of that very last scene where she shows up and leaves the blood trail? Because I thought that was her bleeding and they were going to find her lying on the floor. That wasn't her blood, was it?
No, that was the waif's blood.
So what did you make of that where she actually has the waif's face, didn't she?
She did. She took and put it on the wall, which I guess was, you know, she went back there because I think she knew that the waif was her enemy, but Jaqen H'ghar wasn't.
Yeah.
So she returned it, and maybe she took some other faces or other stuff from the, you know, from them when she was leaving, and poison or whatever, and she took off.
I like that when she tells him I'm, because he'd been waiting for 2 years, right, for her to say I'm already a star. She kept saying I'm no one, and you knew that it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. And finally she says, I'm Arya Stark of Winterfell, I'm going home. And I love it. Somebody compared, what's his name? I can't remember that guy's name.
Jaqen H'ghar.
Jaqen. I love that Jaqen's reaction. Somebody said it was like he becomes Buddy Christ from the from the Jay and Silent Bob movies, where he's kind of like thumbs up and wink at her like, yeah, baby, you know? Hey, what did you make? That's what I'm trying to get at is, what did you make of his reaction at the end? He's kind of, it's almost like he wanted to give her a hug or something. He's like, well, yeah, thumbs up, you know?
I mean, it goes back to what I said. I think that was his intent all along, was he saw this person who had all these people they wanted to kill but didn't have the tools to do it, and he trained her how to do it and kind of set her loose to go wreak her vengeance now.
Yeah,
and he was like, go do it.
It's going to be interesting to go back and watch the early episodes again. I'm going to watch the series over again and get a sense, because I couldn't remember exactly how their relationship started in terms of their conversation. I know he found her, she found him in like the cage or whatever, let him go. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and now you got to wonder, if as good as he is, how did he ever get caught? And did he do that on purpose just to get her to get him out so they could make that little arrangement? I don't know. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's episode 8. Then we get to the one with the great title, Battle of the Bastards. I don't think anybody had any doubt what was coming in this episode, Battle of the Bastards. So,
that, you know, I thought it was going to be entirely in the north, and the opening stuff in Marine was great.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So Dany walks in right where we left off the previous episode, and she's like, I'm going to crucify everybody. I'm like, whoa, okay. But Tyrion kind of, you know, gets her steered onto the path of let's kind of co-opt everything, right? What exactly was Tyrion steering her towards? That wasn't entirely clear to me.
Well, her plan was literally, I'm going to go nuke their cities with the dragons and kill every living thing in this other slave cities.
Yeah.
That's what she said she was going to do.
And Tyrion goes... And that's why Tyrion was saying, that's not that different from what your father was going to do, right?
That's right. And he says, there's other way, like, because in her mind, that's the only way. Like, she, her mind to deal with her enemies, it's, you know, she can't trust them, so she has to annihilate them. That's the only choices. And so Tyrion's like, there are other ways to make them do what we want. Here's how we're going to do it. And so he basically, we demonstrate the power of the dragons by destroying that one ship and get them to surrender all the other ships. And at the same time, they, you know, got the slave soldiers, to surrender. And the other Sons of the Harpy got wiped out by the Dothraki. I guess they were trying to open the gate or something. And then they killed the other wise masters and allowed the one that the other two had said wasn't, you know, was a lowborn and wasn't with them,
yeah,
to carry the message back to everybody else and say, this is what happens if you go against Daenerys.
Honestly, everything else is so great, but I honestly think that may have been my favorite moment in the entire series so far, because it had everything I like. It had snotty, arrogant politicians standing there talking about how your reign is over. We're in charge now. All your soldiers are going to be enslaved. We're going to slaughter your dragons. We're going to do all this crap. And she's like, no. And I love it. Tyrion says, I think there's like a misunderstanding here. We're here to discuss your terms of your surrender. and then Grey Worm comes up and just cuts down two of them in one stroke. And the other guy's just like, mama. And then, that whole bit, and then they Grey Worm tells the soldiers, you can stay here and fight for these guys, it wouldn't do anything for you, or you can go home to your families. And they're all just like, bye, and they cut out and leave those guys standing there. That was awesome. That was really, really great. I just think that was my favorite scene in the entire series so far. So, so we had this great, just major motion picture quality scene of the dragons taking out the ship. And followed pretty quickly by the arrival of Theon and Yara.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
I mean, they were in Volantis a couple episodes ago, so it's fine. And, you know, they had their meeting with Dany. They clearly wanted to make a deal with her, and they did. They said, we'll give you our ships, and, you know, we'd like your help killing our uncle and taking back our kingdom, and then we'll, you know, we swear fealty to you as queen of the whole thing. You let us, you know, have a little bit of independence. And she was like, I'm okay with that as long as you're not being bad guys anymore, so.
And then Dany, because he had another great line. Dany said something to the effect of, are you demanding my hand in marriage or something? And Yara says, well, it's not a demand, but I'm up for anything. I love Yara more. I'll tell you what, I love that character more. I don't remember much of her from the books at all. I think other than just being kind of a mean, you know, sister, Viking sister type. But I got to say that I love this actress. I love the way she plays the character. They give her some great human moments, you know, and everything. I just really like Yara more every episode. I'm really looking forward to it. Now, one point I'm wanting to raise with you. They make the deal there that if they change their Viking ways and serve as dragon Uber, right, then they get to basically be independent, kind of like Dorne has been all this time.
Sure. Sure.
Now, afterwards, Tyrion says something like, well, you know, everybody's going to ask for independence now. And Dany says, well, they can ask. And I'm sitting here thinking, you know, that's where I'm wondering if the North is going, right?
I mean, no. What happened is, what Tyrion said is, everybody's going to demand their independence if you give it to the Iron Islands. And Daenerys says, no. They didn't demand, they asked.
Right. Which is ironic that the most hardcore, violent people of reputation of all of Westeros are the ones that asked, you know? Because it was Theon and Yara, it wasn't Euron who's coming to whip things out and, you know, pursue an entirely different path to Dany, you know? So, are we going to have a sea battle along the way when they come up on Euron's fleet, or are they going to get over to Westeros ahead of time?
No, I think we haven't had a big sea battle, and I think that's something they're definitely going to – I think that's going to be one of the high points of next season. Early in the season probably is a big sea battle between their stuff and Euron's, and maybe the dragons blowing a bunch of ships up and stuff. So that's – I look forward to that. I think that'll be they haven't filmed anything like that.
No, it's got to – Well, it's got to be pretty early because they're already en route, and the narrow sea isn't the wide sea.
Yeah, they're way over in Slaver's Bay, though. So, I mean, I think Euron is going to be there, you know, well before they get to Westeros. They're going to run into him. So,
okay, so that's cool. So we got. So you're starting to form new coalitions is what's interesting. So we'll add more to this in the 10th episode. But right now, you've got the Iron Islands, at least half of them. Teamed up with basically what is effectively the Targaryen house again. Okay, back in the north, Jon and Sansa and the rest of them are coming up on Winterfell, and we already know from the conversation between Ramsay and Papa Bolton a while back that if somebody attacks Winterfell, the smart thing to do is stay inside Winterfell. But the problem is Ramsay can't be content sitting behind his walls. He's got to go out and mess around, which is ultimately his downfall. So they go out to fight, but still you've got to think that the Boltons and all the people on their side make their army way superior to what little we've seen Jon and Sansa be able and Davos be able to put together. So how do you read the whole business with the battle and Jon, Rickon? What are your thoughts on the whole way that the beginning of that battle played out? And then we can talk a little bit about some of the interesting historical, you know, sure, battle techniques and stuff.
I think the point you made is a very important one. Everybody, and we're going to talk about how much of an idiot Jon Snow is, but Ramsay is equally an idiot in the military sense here. Yeah. There was no reason to leave the castle. Nope. He had superior numbers and he had a great fortification. So why go outside? He could have sat up on the wall and said, every day you're out there, I'm going to cut a piece off of Rickon and throw it over the wall at you. you know, here's his finger.
Yep.
And done that every day until John and them left. And they couldn't have taken the castle, even with the, you know, if they had that entire group of archers up there, 1-1 couldn't have gotten to the gate. So, in that sense, Ramsay was just as much of an idiot as John was. John was an idiot. Sansa warned him that Rickon was, we had to write him off. He was dead. He was never going to get away. And that Ramsay was, you know, very tricky and sneaky, and he liked to set traps for people. And John and all of them were like, we're going to stay in our position. But what, you know, it's very easy to say, like, what could get John to leave that position? Well, somebody doing something to Ramsay, I mean, to Rickon. And right. So Ramsay led him out there. And so Ramsay really set it up. His plan for the battle itself was very smart. Once he came out there and set up his forces, you know, he put Rickon out there. He had John come towards him, and then he killed Rickon, and then the archers started shooting at John, and then John's guys came to help him, and then the heavy cavalry was rode down on them and took out a bunch of John's guys. So while they continued, you know, Ramsay's archers continued to shoot even after his own cavalry was in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And then once things started to get, you know, evening out a little bit, then Ramsay's infantry surrounded them and did the little thing with the shields and the spikes, the shields and the spears, kind of a phalanx looking thing where they had their backs up against the mound of bodies and stuff and hemmed them in, and it got really bad there for a while. So John was an idiot. You know, you can't expect your whole army to, you know, behave if the commander acts like a complete moron. And if he doesn't value, I mean, because by going out there, he clearly is basically throwing his life away. And if Jon Snow dies, then what happens to the North? You know, so in that sense, I mean, that's who Jon is. That's the kind of person he is. It's his brother, and he was going to do it. But it was a stupid move. And then he kind of let his army out there piecemeal. And then they also, like, they didn't give 1-1 a tree or anything or a big club. I mean, I'd had guys working day and night to make him a giant hammer or something. So, and you know, maybe some actual, you know, giant-y armor or a shield or something. So, that part was fun. And then, you know, Ramsay runs back in the castle, and it 1-1 breaks down the gate, and then John takes him out.
So we end up with Rickon dead. And yeah, let's talk about the rescue. We knew that Sansa had written off to somebody, and people that did screenshots and blew it up knew it was to Littlefinger or either to the little prince, the Lord of the Vale. Now, what do you make out of all? Let's talk a little bit about Sansa, Littlefinger, and him coming to the rescue here. Clearly, he did it. Littlefinger sent the knights and came with him because he thought there was a percentage in it for him, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he thought that would get him in tight with Sansa, and he could control the North and then march back down south and take the throne and marry her and all that, right? That's pretty much what we know now by the end of episode 10.
Yep. I think my theory is that Sansa knew what kind of person Ramsay was and what kind of person Jon was, and knew that the only way to win was to be cold-blooded and let Jon commit his forces and make Ramsay commit all his forces on the field.
Yeah.
So then the knights could take an advantage. Because if Ramsay is kind of hedging his bets or, you know, keeping some guys back or maybe, you know, heading back to the castle, the knights weren't going to make the difference. But if all Ramsay's guys were out in the open, then that's when the knights could take advantage. So I really think that she used Jon's army for bait because she hated Ramsay and wanted to destroy him. And that's what she had to do.
I think so. I think she wasn't as close to Jon as she was letting on. She kept saying she didn't trust him, right?
Well, I think she hoped to save him with the knights, but she was willing to use him and his army as bait.
Yeah. That raises the question, were the knights there the whole time and just waiting? It wasn't really like a, you know, people compared it to Helm's Deep in the Two Towers, but really this wasn't so much like Helm's Deep where you know, the Rohan Second Army arrives just in the nick of time. I honestly think they were hanging out on the other side of the hill, you know, twiddling their thumbs and filing their fingernails and having lunch and just waiting for Littlefinger to say, now we go in, you know?
Maybe. That would shock me a bit, again, because if they show up earlier, Ramsay retreats into the castle and it's a different game. This was the only way to get complete victory was to let, you know, John's army get chewed up in the meat grinder.
And when we got the scene in episode 10 of Sansa and John sort of talking about everything, I was waiting for John to say, so, how long were you guys there? You know, how many of my men did you allow to die before you decided to intervene?
I don't know, like, if he had any awareness of that because of where he was in the, you know, in the battle and right. stuff. Like, I don't know how much he even knew, you know, maybe afterwards he could ask people that, but.
I feel like if they want to continue the rift that I sense is coming, is forming, and we can talk about that in a minute, we get into season episode 10. But I think if in the next, in season 7, if they want to exploit, if they want to exploit this rift between the two, then they can have a flashback to that and have John say, you know, Sansa, I'm just wondering, how long were you and Littlefinger there before you decided to commit your forces? Just, you know, waiting, you just, you know, didn't really care what happened to me or my men or what. So the Knights of the Vale are currently hanging out in or around Winterfell.
Yes.
Everybody had in that room had to, you know, in episode 10, I'm sorry to be jumping around, but it's just, these are plot threads. In episode 10 at the end, when they're about to do the King of the North bit on Jon, everybody in that room had to look over and see Littlefinger sitting there in the windowsill, whatever he was doing, just kind of over there off to the side watching, and realize this guy's got the biggest, baddest army of anybody in the room.
I think there were some of his lords in there doing the King of the North thing.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That would be interesting.
This is my opinion, is I think some of those guys in that room were Knights of the Vale, you know, the Lords of the Vale.
Well, then he can't be very happy about it. That makes it a lot even worse than I thought, because I thought his reaction was arrival. In the sense of, you know, now there's somebody else that may be coming up as powerful as me. But what you're saying would actually undercut Littlefinger's own potential power.
Mm-hmm. And I think he's looking, you know, and maybe the Knights of the Vale would still listen to him, like if, you know, and Robert told them to do something and he was manipulating Robert, you know?
Yeah.
But I think the scene at the end where they're doing the King of the North thing, and he's looking at Sansa like, you're an idiot. Like, I told you all along you needed to have your own army, and earlier John was telling her he was putting her in the, you know, in the Ward of Winterfell's suite and all that stuff because she was the heir.
Right.
But now all of a sudden he's the King of the North and she's nobody.
Well, that's the thing that I thought was interesting, was all through the episode, they kept deferring to each other. Oh, no, you're the greatest. No, you're the greatest. No, you get the nice room. No, you get the nice room. No, you're the Lord of Winterfell. No, you're the Lady of Winterfell. They kept deferring to each other. But at the end, I felt like Sansa's kind of going, I don't know if I'm happy about this anymore.
That's right.
Interesting. And I hate that, too. But, oh, well. Let's see. So Ramsay ends up getting beaten almost to death, and then Sansa essentially feeds him to his own dogs.
Yes.
Certainly poetic justice, but is it what we want to see have happen to Sansa? Are we happy with that result in her life? I mean,
I am.
Her life choices?
I am, because, you know, Ramsay was, you know, terrible to her in season 5, and
sure,
he deserves whatever he got at her hands. So I think I don't have any problem at all with Sansa dissing out the justice to Ramsay in the most vicious way possible. And I love the scene of her walking away with that little smile.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that, because she was a little naive girl who believed in, you know, princes and chivalry and knights and, you know, that and all this kind of stuff, and she was a fool, and I think that's over the years been stripped from her because she's, you know, been around so many terrible people and so many liars and so many treacherous people that, and I think the other part is you watch, like, she's wearing black at that episode. Like, yeah. So I think it's her, to me, it's like Dark Sansa, you know, it's like Dark Phoenix or whatever. Yeah. That's where she's going.
Yeah, I know. And in a way, I'm glad she's getting revenge and stuff, but I just don't know if any of these characters are ending up where I would have wanted them to be and where I would like them. They're not becoming likable people because of the of what they've had to go through, and that's part of the consequences of this story. Sure. It is such a dark story. Well, let's get into episode 10. We get the fantastic beginning. The trial's about to happen. Cersei has no intention of coming to it. And I love it that Marjorie says something to the effect of, Cersei's not here. That means that she knows she's going to get the punishment for not being here. And clearly she's not worried about the punishment she would get. So therefore, oh my gosh, let's get the heck out of here.
Mm-hmm.
I like that leap of logic, but it was spot on. And then they won't let her out, knuckleheads.
She wouldn't have made it anyhow.
Did you expect the whole thing to go up like, you know, I mean, it was it exploded.
It did. It blew up. It was like it was nuked. It was a really dramatic scene.
It's amazing.
And, you know, the fact that nobody got out, I mean, the High Septon, all the Tyrells, Kevin Lannister, and all the other, you know, the High Septon's people, it was a very, thousands of just King's Landing's, you know, citizens, poor people.
Yeah.
It was a dramatic moment, and there was, you know, Cersei basically saying what she said in the early, you know, I don't know, season two or season three. Maybe even been in season one, where she was talking to Ned Stark, and she said, "When you play this game, you win or you die."
Yeah. Yep.
So.
So yeah, I just I couldn't believe so many people. I guess I expected everything to be on fire. I didn't expect a giant explosion and the whole thing to collapse like that. It was pretty amazing. But we totally called it. You and I both knew that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It took out a whole bunch of people. It's a good thing that Marjorie sent her grandma away because now we've still got her involved. She's too good of a character. She's the dowager of this show. I tell you, she's the Downton Abbey dowager of this show. What about Tommen? What did you think about Tommen just says, well, screw it. Splat.
I mean, I think it was, number one, he was in there alone and there was nobody with him.
Yeah.
And he saw what happened and he knew who did it and who had kept him in his room and who had destroyed the, you know, the sept and killed all those people. And he also knew that
including his wife
and the High Septon, who he had grown to have a relationship with, a friendly relationship with. And Tommen actually believed, you know, in the religion and believed that the church and the crowned with the twin pillars, and he saw his mom basically take one of those pillars and destroy it. And so then what was he going to do? Was he going to turn around and try and execute his mother? Was that even, you know, even if he decided to do that, why would he think that would happen? Because who was left to listen to him? You know, wasn't, because the only other person who wasn't at the sept who was, you know, maybe listened to him was Pycelle, and they took care of him. So there was nobody left who would listen to Tom and carry out his orders versus Cersei. So there wasn't any chance for him to get justice for those people. And so at that point, he realized that, you know, his mother had done this and that he really wasn't the king. He wasn't the person who had absolute power and that he was responsible for all those people dying because he had not put his mom in check and dealt with the situation. And that, you know, his, you know, all those people had died on his watch and his responsibility, and so he killed himself.
And, you know, Cersei could have been there preventing it maybe, but she was busy torturing the Septa.
Yes, exactly.
Torturing her.
She could have gone and checked on her son, but instead she went straight to torturing that woman, and that's when Tama killed himself.
Yeah. So her priorities ended up getting her, biting her in the butt, basically. Leaving her with the zombie mountain, that was pretty disturbing. And let's just jump ahead. She declares herself queen. Now, Jaime comes in at the end when Cersei is sitting her butt on the Iron Throne. She had to be all kind. Now, there's multiple layers here I want to talk about for a second. On the one hand, after everything she had just been, you know how frustrated Cersei was getting all season, because every time she tried to even have a say in things, Kevin and the others would shut her down.
Well, in every season, you know, she's tried to get people to do the things that she wanted them to do, and sometimes she got things done, and a lot of times she didn't. And so she's frustrated because, you know, she said many times, "I wish I had been more in the man. I wish I had, you know, been born and you had been the girl," whatever. And, you know, I think she feels like that she would make better king than Robert or Joffrey or Tommen.
Yeah.
So she was like, "That's it. I'm doing it."
Now, my other question there is, how come Jaime doesn't become king? I mean, I realize that she basically becomes queen just because there's nobody else left. I mean, who else is left? I can't think of anybody left that could be ahead of her. But Jaime...
Gendry.
Yeah, but they don't know that, and that's not really... among people that would be official, they've run out. I mean, Lancel's dead, Kevin's dead... The Tyrells are dead. There's nobody left but Cersei.
Yeah, there's no Baratheons left either.
No.
Stannis and his family are dead. And
the Lannisters, it really is the War of the Roses, because, you know, in the Wars of the Roses, what ultimately happened was the Plantagenets, who had all these kids. The Plantagenets were like the most fertile family in England, and the Plantagenets end up wiping each other out. They're all extinct by the time of the Tudors. They're gone. Mm-hmm. Richard III was pretty much the last one. And so, the Lannisters and the Baratheons both are basically extinct. All you got left are Jaime and Cersei now. And whoever's, you know, manning the... We never see Casterly Rock, so we have no idea who's been keeping the lights on there. There must be some, like, third cousin that just sits there in the throne room of Casterly Rock and is like, "Yep. Another day, another nothing, you know." "Most invulnerable fortress in Westeros. Nobody ever thinks to attack us, so I'm just going to kick back." Although somebody did mention, what's his name? Danny's boyfriend. Danny's boy toy was saying, "Oh, I see. You want me to go attack Casterly Rock. Brilliant move." And she's like, "No, we're breaking up." But no, seriously, why does Jaime not get to be king ahead of Cersei? I mean, I know that she's like 5 minutes older, but he's a man, and that seems to be their male power system, you know?
Do you know why? Because she put the crown on her own head. She has the King's Guard. She has Qyburn. She controls what's going on in the city, and Jaime doesn't control anything. I mean, he has the army he brought with him. Is he going to order the Lannister army he brought with him to attack Cersei and her people?
Well, I just thought that when he rolled in, the people might be like, "Ma'am."
People be like, but again, he's the Kingsguard. He was the Kingsguard. He swore away, he gave away his titles and stuff when he did that.
Yeah.
So.
But he's not technically still Kingsguard, is he?
No, but I think when you swear that oath, you give up all future rights to your title. So he theoretically can't even be ward of Castle Rock. So.
Okay. Well, let's see, a couple other things. Davos finally confronts Melisandre the Red Witch about burning the little girl. And you knew that was coming. I mean, the only thing that surprised me was he didn't just kill her right there or try
to. Yeah, I thought she was going to die.
Yeah. So there's clearly something still out there for her to do.
Yes.
I thought that killing her would serve the purpose of we wouldn't be sitting around every time somebody died wondering why she didn't bring him back to life, like Rickon.
Well, I'm glad that she's out of the way so we don't have that discussion all the time.
Right. Okay, I want to get into this. Varys has been on his secret mission to steal the plans of the Death Star, or something. I don't know what he was doing, but what it ended up like Varys did was he went to Dorne, of all places. Now, that's interesting because, you know, what we had before was a Lannister-Tyrell alliance, and that was why the Lannisters were powerful, was that the Tyrells were pretty powerful. Well, now the Lannisters have basically cut the Tyrells loose. They've served notice that we no longer need your services, Tyrells. So the Tyrells are free to look for other other alliances. And sure enough, Varys is down there in Dorne talking to the Sand People. Didn't mean to sound like Star Wars.
Sand snakes.
Yeah, and here comes Miss Tyrell herself, Tracy Bond, and we get this interesting three-way conversation where it looks like we've got an alliance between Dorne, Highgarden, and the Targaryens. What do you think?
Oh, I absolutely think that's what happened. I think that's what Varys' mission was. He knew they were unhappy with – he knew that Dorne was unhappy with Cersei. And when he heard what happened, you know, he got Olenna Tyrell to come down there so they could talk too. And they're going to team up with Daenerys. She'll probably land down there and give her army time to get settled. And they'll all march up together towards King's Landing.
You get the sense the conversation probably was like what it boiled down to was – was like Varys saying, I've got an army coming over with dragons and stuff, and Lady Tyrell is like, don't really care, not interested anymore, everybody's dead. And Varys is like, well, we plan to burn the Lannisters down and kill Cersei. And she's like, I'm in. Sign me up. Sign me on the dotted line. I'm into that alliance. Couldn't care less about the future. Couldn't care less about the titles or anything. But if it involves blowing up the Lannisters and killing Cersei, then, dude, let me be on the front row with a flamethrower. So we have a very, very interesting – so that what that's cool, though, is that it means that when Dany comes over, she's already got two very formidable armies – theoretically, I assume Dorne has a pretty darn good army. They're good fighters.
They do.
And you know the Tyrell army is pretty formidable. So she should be able to just get right off the boat and have the armies she brought with her and the armies that are there waiting on her.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as she walks off the boat, she will have the biggest army of Westeros.
Man. Where's she going to land? Is she going to land at King's Landing and start kicking ass? Or is she going to land like in Dorne and hook up with those other armies and march north?
To me, she should land south of King's Landing. So, I mean, she could land in the Stormlands and you know, the Tyrells and the Dornish people could march up to the Stormlands, like where Storm's End. That's kind of south of King's Landing. And she could land there, give her army, you know, the Dothraki time to get their legs back under them and stuff while they take Storm's End in that region, and then they could move north towards King's Landing in one group.
Somebody pointed out, too, that Dragonstone is got to be very flimsily defended now with Stannis gone and his army.
Well, that's the other part. She has so many forces, she doesn't have to attack in one group. I mean, she could send the Dothraki out, a big chunk of the Dothraki out into the, you know, the Riverlands and that, you know, in that direction, and then and still have plenty of people to take King's Landing, and she could have another group, you know, take Storm's Dragonstone pretty quickly.
I'm telling you, I really want to see an army lay siege to Castle Rock. We haven't even seen Castle Rock, have we?
No.
If those who don't know, that's the Lannisters' headquarters, and we never see it because the Lannisters are always out in other places like King's Landing or out in the Riverlands or whatever. And I want to see, like I said, Cousin Jethro Lannister that's running Castle Rock. I want to see him sitting there eating his Frosted Flakes, you know, and all of a sudden there's a knock, and he goes and looks out, and there's like a Dothraki army of 100,000 guys, you know, outside Castle Rock. And he's just like, we surrender. That's what I want to see. Let's see. Sam gets to the Citadel.
Yes, with the sword.
Well, I thought it was cool that it's Alexandria. You got the giant lighthouse of Alexandria. You've got the Library of Alexandria. It's essentially Alexandria in ancient Egypt. After, you know, Alexander the Great comes through, and he's just in hog heaven, isn't he?
He is. When he goes in the library, he's awestruck. It is, and the library was awesome. It really was.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah. He's just like, I love you, library. He's totally forgotten about Gilly and Little Sam Jr. and everything. He's just all that's there was. I love that the big empty hall. And when he goes back there with the guy, I said to Amy, I said, I said, just go ahead and have a seat in our waiting room. I'm sorry, we don't have any chairs, but you can just have a seat here in our waiting room. He'll be back in a few days, you know. You can just see a thing like 3 days later, Sam looks up, Gilly, the baby.
Well, and remind me when we get to the future, I want to come back to this and have some thoughts about what Sam's going
to
do there.
All right, let's move on to, we talked about Sansa and Jon, and we know that winter has come. King of the North. What did you think about, did you expect Jon to be declared King of the North by the assembled Lords of the North?
I did not, and it gave me a bad feeling, I got to be honest. Because it didn't work out well for the last King of the North.
Yeah.
And it really kind of screwed up the things with Sansa, so I didn't want it.
I know, that was a thing, and Jon was so dumbstruck. I mean, he could have just...
What's he going to say? Nah.
Like, hold on, this is Sansa's party. Don't make it about me here, you know, but that little girl would have been like, what kind of wimp are you? I'm trying to make you King of the North. Shut up, boy. She is awesome. Somebody said they need to have a show. Somebody on Twitter said they need to have a show with her, just like nothing but her 10 hours a season belittling grown men. Okay, well, we'll kind of get back to that in the summary. And then last couple of things. Cold Hands drops off Bran and Mira near the wall at the tree. And he gets to finish, for the most part, the Tower of Joy scene, and where we at least find out that her baby is Jon Snow, because they do that very obvious, heavy-handed, but very effective deal where they zoom in on the baby, and then I said, as soon as they zoom in on the baby, I said, you know what's coming next? We're about to hard smash cut into Jon, and boom, there was Jon. I'm like, well, that was knocked us over the head with it, but they just want to make sure everybody gets it. Now, here's the thing, Jon. This is what I've been talking about all week. And I raised this question on Facebook and people were disagreeing with me, but I haven't really talked to you about it. They've made it very clear now. I mean, they met through the dialogue. I pay a lot of attention to how they structure the dialogue in these kind of scenes to see what they're trying to emphasize, right? If this is how I watch the show, I think, what are they trying to get the lowest common denominator viewer to get? You know, in other words, the dumbest viewer. Maybe that's me, I don't know, but what are they trying to emphasize so that the dumbest, least informed viewer still goes, oh, I get that. And in that scene, it was, this is Ned's sister, and this is Ned's sister's baby. They hammered. Oh, sister, how are you, sister? Okay, brother, I'm not doing so good, brother. Okay, sister. They just hammered at that. I get it. Okay, so that's your sister. She's had a baby. Clearly there have been complications. She wants you to take care of the baby. Who is the baby? Boom, Jon Snow. Who never got mentioned in that scene?
Father.
Now, we know from the bigger context who it is. But But the show has never made it very clear, have they?
Well, but she says, she whispers to him, if Robert finds out, he'll kill him.
I didn't hear that part. Was that when
she's whispering to him, and you can't hear everything she says, but at one point she says, Robert will kill him, you know it.
Okay. Well, that's true, yeah.
And you know that about Robert Baratheon, that he would have killed the baby.
Yeah.
So that's why Ned had to lie about who Jon's parents were. But that still doesn't answer the dad question.
Right, because that's the thing is that – and see, the argument I've been having is how important that is. I feel like there was no point for them to even go into it until they established to the audience who he is and why he matters. And I just don't think there was enough time. I just don't think you wanted at the end of this season – at the end of this season as we're wrapping everything up, did you want to have to basically introduce and roll out a whole new – now, I know he's not a new character, but to much of the audience, he would have come across as a whole new character, wouldn't he?
Who, Rhaegar?
Yeah.
I have an alternate theory.
Well, let's pursue it. But first, answer me that. Much of the audience, if they brought up Rhaegar, then people are like, who?
No, they've talked about Dany and her people talked about Rhaegar. Yeah. They've said Rhaegar the Last Dragon and Rhaegar took your sister and all. I think they've sold that.
Okay.
And I think everybody gets that it's the sister and a Targaryen's baby. Okay. And everybody assumes it's Rhaegar, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think it's probably 90% it's Rhaegar.
Right. Well, who else it could be? That's who was in love with her.
I don't know. There's somebody else. Are you ready? Are you sitting down?
I am.
His dad, the Mad King.
Well, how the hell?
Okay. A, that would still make Jon a Targaryen.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's and that was a reason for the Kingsguard to be there. Okay.
All right.
His children had problems surviving. A lot of his children didn't make it. And his wife and other women had difficult births. So that's part of the connective. And the idea that, you know, this was something that was done to Lyanna, that Rhaegar loved her, but that he was off gone fighting the war and the dad did this. And I would even go a step further and say, here's the, if you want to go, you know, crazy town, the dragon has three heads theory. He raped her and he raped Tywin Lannister's wife.
And that's Tyrion.
Yes. And she died during childbirth.
So he raped her. It wasn't like she was secretly in love with Rhaegar's father or something.
No, good gosh, no. He was a nut job and she loved his son. Okay. So, I'm not saying that's it. I think it's 90% that it's Rhaegar and it's Rhaegar. Rhaegar's the dad. But I'm saying the only other potential now, up until now, there was debate about if this was the real theory. But now the only debate is Rhaegar or the dad. Those are the only two possible scenarios. And again, it's, 90-95% Rhaegar.
Interesting. All right. We know that as long as Bran stays where he is, the White Walkers are kind of up there in the north. When you listen to the dialogue and think about it strategically, they say things. They don't waste a lot of words.
Nope.
So they went to great lengths to say how the wall is put together with magical spells. It's not just a wall, which makes me think that Bran with the mark coming through the wall, going through the gate or whatever, is going to open the wall up to the White Walkers being able to come through.
I agree. I think that's what happens.
So he needs to stay up there above the wall, but he's not, obviously.
He's going to go through and that's going to be it.
Oh boy. Way to go, Bran. Another Stark screwing everything up.
Stark men. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. We talked about Arya. I did think it was interesting that Arya we saw her earlier in that same disguise, and wasn't Bronn talking about her or something?
Well, and he's pointing her out like she was staring at Jaime Lannister.
And now we know why.
Yes, because she recognized him.
Yeah.
And she was like, he doesn't recognize me, and I could, maybe I could kill him or whatever. But, Jaime's not on the list.
I'm surprised she didn't slip him some poison or something.
He's not on the list.
Well, yeah, but he ought to be.
He pushed Bran out the window, but.
Yeah, well. So that was just interesting that Bronn and Jaime were talking about her, and she turned out to be Arya. And we talked about that scene already. Pretty gross, but effective for Arya. Man, she was really reveling in blood, wasn't she? My gosh, poor little thing. And then lastly, we talked about the ships, but we didn't talk about Tyrion gets a promotion.
Honestly, about all the scenes in this episode, that is the scene that got to me.
Mm.
Because I love Tyrion. He's my favorite character. And the scene where she gives him the Hand of the Queen pin and he talks about being a cynic and believing in her and stuff really got to me. And I thought it was great. I thought it was really well done. And I think Tyrion's character arc is so good in this show.
Yeah.
And the writing of that character is so good. And because everything he's gotten in his life has been because he was a Lannister and he was Tywin Lannister's son and he was, doing these things because he was a Lannister. And this is something he got on his own and he earned it. And she believes in him because he's Tyrion, not because he's Tywin Lannister's kid. So I think it's important, and I think it's a big moment for him as a character. And I mean, it made me really happy. So
that was pretty cool. She got the little pin for him and everything. I said he was the dragon claw of the queen instead of the hand. So, all right. So that gets us pretty much through. And then we have the big ships leaving out and crossing the Narrow Sea. Really an amazing three episodes. You know, I mean, stuff happened in them that we never really thought. And I want to preempt one of our questions, because I think one of our questions was something to the effect of, did this all seem too predictable or not nearly as creative, right? And I want to go ahead and ask that, because that's while we're talking about the ending. What are your feelings in regard to whether this was all too predictable or too pat or too conventional?
I don't think it was conventional, but I do think parts of it were predictable. And I think parts of it were also what we wanted to see.
Right.
And that doesn't make them bad. I mean, the
right.
fact that Arya comes back and kills Walder Frey was predictable, but it doesn't make it bad. I think it was very satisfying as an audience member to see that. Yep. And I think, you know, more Cersei blowing up the Sept. I didn't see that scale of it. I didn't see no one escaping. And I didn't see her making, you know, Tommen dying and her making herself queen.
No.
So I think those were great plot twists. I mean, again, the High Septon has really dominated the last two seasons in a lot of ways in King's Landing.
Yeah.
And she nuked him. And so, you know, she enjoyed that. She reveled in it. And so, you know, now she's tired of listening to people. She put herself on the throne. So I think that was – I didn't see her doing that, but I thought, blowing it up was predictable. But it doesn't mean it wasn't satisfying and good. And I think the Tower of Joy stuff, it was predictable as a book reader. But, again, I still have a little bit of doubt in that. So some of it was predictable, but at the same time – as the story moves forward, we've talked about this, you have to start pulling the threads back together.
Right.
And they're at that point. And so sometimes when those threads come together, it's going to be predictable.
Exactly.
How it happens and that kind of stuff. And so, you know, like the Knights of the Vale saving Jon Snow and them, that was predictable. But the didn't mean that episode wasn't really entertaining to watch. I mean, the cinematography in that Battle of the Bastards episode was unbelievable.
Yeah,
just the what they did with the horses and the, you know, guys flying all over the place, and then the scene where John starts to get suffocated, that's another one where I was like, oh my gosh.
Well, let me just say that my answer to that question is this: one of the things that's made this show stand out so much, so unique, has been that it cut against the grain of what we expected time and time again. But you come to a point where you have to make this decision. Either the show is going to cut against the grain and surprise you constantly till the very end and thereby give you a bad ending, like a not a happy ending, but like everybody dies and the ice zombies win and it's all screwed forever and, you know, the end. Or at some point, things have to start getting better. But when things get better, that's more of a conventional story, and so it's more predictable. So it's like either the show had to get more predictable and less shocking, or it had to get much darker and have not really much of a good ending. You see what I'm saying?
That may still happen.
Well,
But there aren't that many characters left that we started with.
No.
So I don't think – I mean, again, High Septon was the main character. He's dead. You know, Frey is dead. Somebody else died in this episode.
Who didn't die in this episode?
Well, Ramsay was a big character. He's dead.
He's dead, sure.
Roose
Bolton?
He's been dead a while.
The Waif.
But I think those things, over the course of the season, I think that really evened out. And it was fine. I think season 5 was actually the weakest season by far. And it's because of the book materials, or, you know, that the last book is the weakest, the one that's come out. Not the Dance of Dragons. The fourth book was
Feast for Crows.
Feast for Crows is the worst, and they were using a lot of the Feast for Crows stuff. And some of the Dance of Dragons stuff is very weak. It's very kind of travel loggy.
Yeah. They cut a lot of that out, too.
They did, because they needed to. It was, you know, Tyrion rides on a boat in a river, describes everything he sees for 500 pages. So,
I thought last season was by far my least favorite. I think this season was by far my most favorite. Because in the earlier seasons, the big shocking moments were all pretty much bad. This has been the only season where the big shocking moments were mostly good. I mean, even when Cersei wins and blows up that building, she still kills a whole lot of people I wanted dead.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, say what you will about everything else she does. She blew up the dang High Sparrow and a bunch of the dang sparrows.
You didn't like them.
Amen. Cersei, woo! I'm voting for you in the election. She took out the sparrows. That's all her slogan needs to be, and she's got my vote. What, we got any listener questions?
We have a few. The first question is from Never Been Wrong Guy. Mm-hmm. His question is, does Tyrion or Jaime kill Cersei? He says, I guess Tyrion, but who knows? I think so.
Well, it has to be a little brother, right?
Yeah. Again, in the show, they have not used that part of the prophecy.
Okay.
So I don't think we're limited to that. So I think in the show, it could be anybody. Theoretically, but I think it's going to be Jaime or Tyrion, and I honestly think it's going to be Jaime.
I think that because Cersei's made it this far, I think if she was going to die before the end, it was going to be at the end of this season. But instead, since she's outmaneuvered everybody and she's still alive, I think she's in it to the end. I mean, okay. She's going to die before things are over, but I think she's got a long way to go yet, because now she's the evil Disney queen, you know?
She is.
So she's got a ways to go yet, I think. And that's good, because I like Lena Headey a lot.
All right, here's another one. Chad Kurtemeyer says, is it Chad Allen Crete? He says, when do you think the wall comes down, season 7 or season 8?
There's got to be enough time after it to deal with the snow creatures. So I'm going to say it's the finale of next season.
I think that's right. You can't. It can't be too early next season, because you can't have that much with them. I don't think.
Right. I think, but you got to have several seasons. I mean, several episodes where they're moving south.
Sure. Absolutely.
And you're preparing for the big battle.
Yes, and losing battles on the way.
Yeah.
All right. Will Collier says, are the Starks the worst excuses for military leaders ever? And why didn't John yell serpentine, serpentine? Which is exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, it's like that scene in Prometheus where they run in a straight line from the spaceship that's falling in a straight line. I mean, yeah, the Starks have just never been the most brilliant. And they let their emotions get in the way, and they do the valiant thing, which is often the self-sacrificing thing, and ends up sacrificing everybody else. That's what I always said was wrong with Ned Stark. It's bad enough that he gets himself killed, but he gets his whole family screwed over.
That's right.
Look what's become of them because of his stupidity.
All right. Another question from Chad. He says, do you think the showrunners blocked out Lyanna saying who Jon's father was? Is it another plot twist, or are they just dragging it out?
I think that they're dragging it out because they didn't want to have to go into all that at this point in the series, in the season. I think there's going to be an episode next season where Bran gets the whole Rhaegar story. I just I know everybody disagrees with me, but I think they're going to explain to us, like the simple-minded fools we are, they're going to lay it out. They're going to spoon-feed us. Well, here's Rhaegar. Here's who he was. They're going to cast some actor to play him, and then you're going to find out.
There's another way they could learn this, and I was reading something about this today. Who was the only other person at the Tower of Joy with Ned?
Howland Reed?
Howland Reed. And so Bran is with Mirror Reed.
Right.
They could go visit Howland and have this discussion out loud about Jon's parents.
Okay. Where's he?
He's at his secret castle in the swamps, Greywater Watch.
Okay.
Which we've never seen, which is the Reed's secret swamp fortress, basically.
All right. Works for me.
All right. Emily Rios says, what a great episode. Is Sansa happy for Jon? Is she upset that he's king of the North, or is she relieved she doesn't have to marry Littlefinger?
I think it's all of the above. I think she's not really sure what to think now, and that's the problem, because Littlefinger's going to step in and try to manipulate her feelings now to get her onto his side and to undermine and drive a wedge between her and John. That's what I sense coming in the next little...
Yeah, but I think she's gotten much better at this. And I think, like, when she gave Littlefinger the brush off,
yeah,
I thought that was great. And that was a real difference for that character. She didn't stand there and,
right,
you know, be scared. And she was like, no, hey, ain't happening.
What about Robin? I mean, it's not like Littlefinger's lord of the area. He's just like the uncle and, you know, the stepfather and advisor.
Exactly right. I think the ultimate – if Sansa wants to, like, cut him out, the ultimate move is she marries Robin.
Oh, shoot.
Because then it's like, oh, I'm sorry, Peter Baelish, we don't need you anymore.
Splat.
That's right.
Have you met the Moondor? Oh, my goodness, Littlefinger. Hey, he's interesting, though. I don't want him to go too soon. I like an interesting character like that.
But again, like, the entire thing is his actions stirring the pot a lot.
Yeah, that's right. That's like
listener questions.
I like when Littlefinger and Varys used to be together, because that was like the two most brilliant mastermind behind the scenes schemers that everybody takes lightly, but they're like the most brilliant minds in all of Westeros. And when those two get together, you're like, oh boy. So last couple of things. You've raised a couple of good questions here. We're way off the books now. We don't know when we're going to get the actual book called The Winds of Winter. So where do you see all that? What's going to come of that?
It's interesting, because I really think, like, we've reached a point where the TV show development has got to be impacting his writing of the books. Mm-hmm. And he's seeing what works, it doesn't work, and changing things based on that feedback.
Yeah.
So I do think, you know, Winds of Winter is probably going to come out before next year's TV show. So the books are going to leap ahead again and be ahead of the show. And that'll mess up a bunch of stuff. And things will be different in the books, because characters are in different places and all that kind of stuff. So that'll be very different. But it may not. He may not make it before next year's show. He may not release a book at all before the TV show ends. That wouldn't stun me either. It's been this long.
I'll just say this. If I were writing these books and then there was a TV show being made out of them and I watched it, like I'm sure he's watching these, I would be so confused going forward. I have, you know, I write books, John. I have two series going. I have a hard enough time keeping track of them without anything to compete with my understanding of the plots and the characters. If somebody was doing a movie of the Sentinels and, like, Pulsar died two seasons ago and Ultra was, like, living on Mars or something, I would be so confused. I wouldn't know how to write the books.
Well, and if they develop some elegant TV-style solution to some of the problems he set up, he could be like, oh, I was going to do this big complicated thing, but that's much better. I'll just rewrite it that way.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably happening some. And also, I think, like – but the other part is, again, like, he set up these long character arcs to reveal these things, like the Hodor thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was his setup to reveal, and he didn't get to because – you know, the TV shows were ahead of him.
Yeah.
So, and there's more of that. So I think that part, you know, I feel bad for him, honestly. But he got himself in this thing because he rides too slow.
And he's crying all the way to the bank.
Yeah, that's right. So I don't feel that bad for him. But, you know, it's a tough one.
So we see the last two seasons as next season kind of Danny gets to Westeros. The armies start marching around.
Well, and the big battle with Euron early.
Yeah. You get the consolidation of three power centers, right? You get Danny's power center, Cersei's power center, and Jon's power center. But we don't know now what Sansa and Littlefinger's position will be vis-a-vis that, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, he could just turn right back around and ally with Cersei again. Who knows? Whatever he thinks works best for him.
That's right.
And point his finger at the North and say, those crazy Northmen tried to, you know, they've called themselves King of the North now. They're rebelling again. So you got the three power centers. And then, of course, at some point, Bran goes under the wall and we end the season with the White Walkers come pouring down. That leaves our last season to have basically everybody stop your civil war and fight an ice zombie, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why I could see that season not needing to be 10 episodes long.
No, because it would be, you know, what are we doing? What's the threat? How do we work together to stop it? And, you know, everybody basically running for their lives from the zombies, and, you know, winter's kind of laying over the land and stuff, and then they're trying to figure out what they're going to do. So,
and we got Sam down in the Citadel. He's going to find the right book, isn't he?
He is. He's going to find the right book. But the other thing about the Citadel and the Maesters, I think, is going to come out in the books and the TV show is they're kind of the anti-magic people.
Yeah.
They're for technology and progress and science, and they view magic as bad. And I think, you know, there were these kind of hints in the books that the Maesters were kind of behind the elimination of the dragons and that kind of stuff before, because they don't want magic in the world. And so, you know, they want their science to be what everybody needs. So I think it's going to be interesting to see if Sam runs into some of that when he's down there doing his research.
All right. Well, I think we about reached the end. Any last thoughts about season 6 as we lay it to rest and have our long layoff before season 7?
No, it's upsetting that we have so far to go. I mean, that is so long before we get another episode, because that episode was so great. I literally stopped last night and I watched the whole thing again, even though I needed to get up and go to work today because I enjoyed it so much. And it was so much in there. I wanted to see it again. So
yeah, I want to watch the whole season over again, I think, back to back once it's done now. I think that my last thoughts are about this season, where this was such a great season. So much stuff happened. Even when stuff wasn't happening, stuff was happening, you know. And we just got so much movement and so much change and all the pieces on the board. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that 10 episodes ago, I was threatening to quit watching the show.
Mm-hmm.
10 episodes ago, the big exciting thing that got everybody stirred up was Sansa's rape or something like that, or the little girl being burned. How far we've come from that, you know?
Yep.
Fleets of ships and dragons and battles and catapults and Battle of the Bastards and Arya's faceless assassin. And
blowing the sept up. Blowing Queen Cersei.
What a season this has been. Just the last three episodes that we've been talking about is almost, we need to do one show for each one. Like you said, Daily Show would have been the beta way to go.
Next season.
All right. Well, we'll catch back up on Game of Thrones either when the next book comes out or when the next show, when the show starts again. We'll see which one happens first. But let me point out here in closing that I've been telling you the Avengers Assemble podcast is coming. It is here. My little 5-minute introduction episode is up now on Podbean and on iTunes. So if you like the Avengers, the movies, the comics, whatever, then check out Avengers Assemble, the podcast. It's from White Rocket Entertainment. It'll be our third show along with this show and the football show. And I'm sure I'll have John on a few times there. And I've got a whole bunch of other guests lined up to talk about the Avengers. So check that out. It's up there now. All right. I reckon the Rocket's going to get on out of here for another week. John, thanks for coming on to talk about this awesome show.
All right. Valor Morghulis.
Morghulis. And I guess we will see you guys next season and down the road.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek. Classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.